in the practice of one reality, ekatattvabhyasa, mentioned by Sage Patanjali in one of his sutras for the purpose of restraining the modifications of the mind, there are again grades of approach. The one reality is not necessarily the absolute reality, though that is the aim ultimately. As it was mentioned yesterday, a reality for the purpose of practice is that condition which can fulfill a particular need of a specific state of mind under a given condition. So, until the absolute reality is reached, all other realities are relative realities. Every reality, as far as we are concerned empirically, is relative, subject to transcendence. Nevertheless, it is a reality to us, which only goes to prove that we also are relative realities only. We as individuals are not absolute reality, and therefore we are satisfied with what is relative. We are not daily in contact with the absolute. What we are in contact with is a relative reality. And inasmuch as the subject of experience and the object experienced are on a same level or degree of reality, it goes without saying that the empirical subjects that we all are come under relative reality alone and not the absolute reality. So, in the concentration of the mind on one reality, ekatattva, what is intended is that the attention should be focused on a system or order of values which is immediately superior to or transcendent to the current state of affairs, the present state of experience, the condition through which we are passing at this moment. Anything which can include particulars in a more organized whole can be regarded as a higher reality for this purpose. We have tentative realities created for the purpose of practical convenience by organizations or associations or systems which we have created for the purpose of subjugating the individual ego and compelling it to affiliate itself to a larger body to which also it ought to belong and is made to belong. Now, I can give you examples of quantitative systems which we create in our practical daily life for the purpose of overcoming the urges of the ego and connecting it with wider or larger holes. A physical individual or a bodily person is the lowest unit of reality, as far as our experience goes. An utterly selfish individual is one who looks upon the body as the ultimate reality and the only reality. There is nothing else. Now, this is the grossest form of egoism, where the bodily individuality is regarded as the only reality and everything else is completely ignored. This is the animal's way of thinking to some extent. The tiger has no concern over anything except its own personal existence. And it can pounce on anyone for the sake of its own security, existence, etc. Now, this animal's way of thinking persists in the human level also. And often, many times we should say, the urge to assert one's bodily individuality vehemently gains the upper hand, though rationally it would be not possible for anyone to justify the exclusive reality of a bodily personality. This was, as they say, the primitive condition of people in prehistoric times or Paleolithic times, as they say, when the human beings were not yet evolved to the present condition of social understanding. If you read the biological history of mankind right from creation, as far as the mind can go, it is said that the evolution of the human individual right from the lowest levels included certain conditions of human existence which were inseparable from animal life. The caveman, the Neanderthal man, and such other primitive types of existence point to an animal mind operating through a human body, where cannibalism was not unfamiliar. One could eat another, because the animal mind was not completely absent even in the human body. And there was insecurity on account of it being possible for one man eating another man. And it took ages, perhaps, as history tells us, for the primitive mind to realize the necessity to come into an agreement among individuals for the purpose of security. If I start jumping upon you, you start jumping upon me, both of us will be unhappy and insecure, and you would not know whether you will be safe or I cannot know that I will be safe. This sort of thing was most undesirable. So it is said by anthropologists and historians of mankind's evolution that a state was reached when it became, when it was felt necessary to organize people into groups, and this was the beginning of the governmental system, as political historians tell us. A government is nothing but an agreement among people, in order that there may not be warfare among individuals and attack every day. Otherwise, there will be chaos, confusion, and anybody will attack anyone at any moment for any reason whatsoever. So an agreement was made, an organization was set up, a rule was framed, and a system was brought forth under which it was obligatory on the part of individuals to obey certain principles laid down by groups, of which one or two or three or a few were made the leaders. These are the leaders of the government. It does not mean that these leaders are kings or autocrats. They were the governors of law, the dispensers of justice. and the instruments for the maintenance of order in the group of people who found it necessary to bring about this system. So, here you have a higher reality than the individual quantitatively looked at, though qualitatively you cannot say that there was any improvement. Because while there is a quantitative improvement in an organization or a setup in a government, in the sense that an individual is made a part of a larger body, so that the egoism of the individual cannot operate as forcefully as it could when it is left alone and given a long rope. And so a consideration for the welfare of other individuals becomes obligatory on the part of every individual on account of the presence of this order and system. So far, so good. From the point of view of the quantity of the reality that has been introduced into life, the mathematical measure of the order that has been set up, we can say that a society is a larger reality than the individual. A nation is a larger reality than a community. And the entire setup of mankind, the international system, may be regarded as a still larger reality than a single nation. This is a quantitative evaluation of the reality at which the human mind seems to be aiming for the purpose of bringing peace on earth, happiness, etc. But this is not the type of reality which Patanjali is thinking of in his mind, though this type of reality cannot be completely ignored. While it is true that a social system is a quantitatively higher reality than an individual body, for reasons obvious, because without it, life would be impracticable, it is not wholly true that an ordered society is qualitatively superior to the individual. That is why there is still insecurity persisting. Even with the best government, there can be insecurity and unhappiness. Because after all, the individuals are behind this quantitative system called this ordered whole. 100 million people thinking cannot always be qualitatively superior to one man thinking. After all, it is man thinking, not God thinking. You must know that. 100 million people thinking means people thinking only. It is man thinking. So qualitatively it is human thinking only. Though quantitatively it has a larger force on account of the inclusion of many individuals. This is a very interesting subject in political science, where political thinkers differ in their opinions as to whether there is a total absence of improvement in quality when there is social order and there is only a quantitative increase, or there is also an element of increase of quality in thinking. This has led to divergent opinions among statesmen and political philosophers, right from Plato onwards, Aristotle onwards, and Chanakya and onwards, people in India, where the opinion swung like a pendulum on either side. The one side thinking that there is absolutely no improvement in quality, though there is a large improvement in quantity. The other side thinking there is an element of qualitative superiority. We are not going to discuss this subject at present because it is outside the jurisdiction of our present discussion. However, the point on hand is a larger reality should be qualitatively also superior to the discrete particulars from which the mind is supposed to be withdrawn for the purpose of the practice of yoga. And though it is a little easy to bring about a quantitative increase in the concept of reality by methods such as the ones I mentioned just now, it will be a little more difficult to introduce a qualitative increase in the concept of reality. This is the main difficulty of everybody. However much you may concentrate on God, you will not be able to improve upon the human concept, even when there is a concept of God only. So you feel unhappy even when you are meditating on God, because you have not improved the quality, you have only increased the quantity. So that you may think of God as a large human human individual, a massive individual, expansive as the universe itself, for example. That is so far very wonderful. But still, this human thought doesn't leave us. Even when we think of the Creator as a transcendent Father, yet the anthropomorphic idea persists and stultifies the aim at introducing a higher quality of thought in the concept of God. That is why we are unhappy even in meditation, even in our highest spiritual exalted moods. Because even when we are exalted, we are quantitatively exalted, qualitatively we are very poor. We are unhappy somehow or other. Nobody can make us happy. But a tremendous effort is necessary to introduce a quality superior in the concept of reality. The difficulty in this being that the mind is the only instrument that we have got in doing anything whatsoever. And who is to introduce a higher order of value or a greater quality into this concept, except the mind, of course. And how can you expect the mind to conceive a higher quality of reality than the one in which it is itself found at the present moment? How can you jump over your own skin? Is it possible? How can you expect the mind to think of a reality superior in quality to the one in which it is living at present and with which it is identified wholly? Well, an immediate answer to this question cannot be given. But there is an answer to this question. Sadhana is a very mysterious process. It is not like ordinary efforts that we put forth in our workaday life. Every effort, even the first effort in the practice of sadhana, brings about an improvement. And the impetus that is created by the first step that you take will carry you forward with a greater impetus towards the next step by the generation of a force which is superior to the powers of the mind in its ordinary operations. Also, there is a peculiar something in the human nature which is called aspiration. It is difficult to understand what it actually means. It is not merely hoping for something in the ordinary sense. It is a surge of the soul's force from within. You must underline this word, soul's force, not merely the mental faculties, which rises up, wells up within us in a totality of action, drawing forth the whole value that we are at present and pointing to something which is wholly other than the present whole from which the soul is being drawn. The meritorious deeds that you performed in previous lives, the good karmas of your past, produce a force called apurva in Mimamsa parlance. The good karmas of the past are present in the mind even now as a kind of prarabdha. And when that prarabdha is of a sattvic nature, it permits the rise of a novel type of asking by the soul, which is called spiritual aspiration. And it is this peculiar context, which is inscrutable, of course, to anyone's mind, which brings a person in contact with a guru. How you come in contact with your guru, you cannot understand. It is worked up by mysterious forces within, associated with your previous good deeds of past lives, etc., which permits good actions in this present birth and makes it possible for you to think divine thoughts and take the initial step in the practice of yoga, which initial step, as I mentioned, is capable of generating a peculiar potency enough to carry you forward to the next step, like a chain action in an atomic bomb burst, as they say, so that every step is an urge towards another step automatically. And the more you practice sadhana, the more you become strong, the greater is your capacity to understand, to enlarge your perspective of thinking, and to contact reality in deeper profundity. Many factors operate in spiritual practice. One is the good deeds that you did in the past. The second is the associations that you have established in society with wise people in this present birth. The practical experience that you gain by living in this world, the initiation that you have received from the Guru and the wisdom that you acquire from the Guru. And finally, most mysterious of course, the grace of God Himself, which is perennially operating, perpetually working, and infinitely and most abundantly contributing to the onward march of the soul towards its goal. The practice of yoga is nothing but a conscious participation in the universal working of nature itself. And therefore it is the most natural thing that you can do, the most natural thing that you can conceive. There can be nothing more natural than to participate consciously in the evolutionary work of the universe, which is the attempt of the cosmos to become self-conscious in the absolute. Evolution is nothing but a movement of the whole universe towards self-awareness. This is called God realization. And every activity of ours, even a cup of tea that you take, is a part of that activity. Nothing, even a breath that you take, even the sneeze that you get forth, and the least action that you perform, even a single thought that occurs in your mind, everything is a part of that cosmic operation, which is the evolution of the universe towards self-realization. And therefore, the practice of yoga is the most natural thing that you can think of and the most necessary duty of a human being. Nothing can be more obligatory on your part than this duty. And from this point of view, perhaps it is that towards the end of the Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna proclaims, Sarva Dharman Parityajya Mamekam Sharanam Vraja. Renounce every other duty and come to me for rescue. Which means to say, take resort in the law of the absolute. That is the practice of yoga. and every other dharma is subsumed under it and included under it. As every river, every drop is in the ocean, in this supreme duty, every other duty is included. There is no need to think of every individual, discrete, isolated duty. Because all duties are included in this one duty, which is the mother of all duties. Now, this peculiar feature of spiritual practice, sadhana, being so difficult to understand intellectually, cannot be regarded as merely an individual's affair. It is God's affair ultimately. Spiritual sadhana is God's grace working. Though it looks that individual effort is there, it only looks, but really it is something else. Not even the greatest thinker philosophically like Shankara could answer logically the question how knowledge rises in the jiva. How can you say that individual effort produces knowledge of God? Knowledge of God cannot rise by individual effort, because individual effort is so puny, so inadequate to the purpose, for the task, that you cannot expect such an infinite result to follow from a finite effect, finite cause. The concept of God is an inscrutable event that takes place in the human mind. Can you imagine an ass thinking God? However much it may put forth effort, it may go on trying its best throughout its life, the concept of God will never arise in an ass's mind or a buffalo's mind. So, how it arises is a mystery. Suddenly it comes. So, it has been said that all great things are mysteries. They are not calculated effects produced by imagined causes logically, but they are mysteries, which is another way of saying that all this is unthinkable by the human mind. Knowledge somehow rises. One fine morning, you get up and find that you are fired with a love for God. What has happened to you? Why suddenly you say, oh, today I am something different? Why you are something different today? From where you got this inspiration? Nobody knows what has happened. If you read the lives of great masters, sages and saints, you will find that they were all suddenly fired up with a longing which they could not explain, or nobody can explain ordinarily. That knowledge, that aspiration, that love of God has not come from books. It has not come from any imaginable source. It has simply come up. That's all. How? Nobody knows. So, inasmuch as it is a super logical mystery, there would be no necessity on our part to investigate the causes thereof and the methods thereof logically or scientifically beyond a certain limit. Though logical and scientific thinking is a help to corroborate the presence of this aspiration that is already there. We have already an aspiration inside. It is not created by logical thinking. And therefore, this logical thinking or whatever it is only a bulwark that we create to reinforce the aspiration that is already there. You already have faith in God. You already believe that God realization is the goal of life. That has taken possession of you already. And now all that you do is only an ancillary process, which is contributory to strengthening this aspiration and enabling it to become more and more potent and influential in your daily life. You cannot create God's concept by any amount of effort. So sadhana is nothing but the intensifying of this flame that has already been lit up in us by God Himself ultimately. If you are all here today, it is due to God's grace. Not because you have money to purchase a ticket and you come to Rishikesh and sit before me. It is not money that has brought you here. It is not your effort that has brought you here. It is nothing of the kind. It is the divine mystery that has operated in a very inscrutable and marvelous manner for a purpose which is cosmic in significance and not merely individual as you can imagine. So you are all here for a cosmic purpose. and a divine purpose, which is a coincidence and a collocation of factors, which can be understood only by the cosmic thinker, God Himself. And I have been always holding that ultimately it looks that God is doing sadhana for God realization, and nobody else can do it. And meditation is nothing but God thinking God. Hari Om Tat Sat.